Our final case this morning is 2021-1529. Council present. EMOI Services LLC versus the Owners Insurance Company. For owners, we have Ms. Moore.
Yes, Erin Moore.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Erin Moore. I represent Owners Insurance Company. In this question of first impression before the court today, this is a matter of first impression because of the context in which it arises. A cybersecurity breach that affected a business that maintained a traditional all-risk property insurance policy. Cyber violations, information risks, information breaches are an epidemic. No different, really, than the COVID epidemic that we've recently dealt with. The last reports I saw indicated that the frequency of such breaches occur on the basis of seconds across the globe, not hours and not days, and thus the importance of getting the clarity and guidance in this situation that we're requesting. As indicated, this involves a general property insurance coverage under a general policy. The key terms at issue are direct physical loss and damage. You've heard those terms before. They've been before you before. In this context, it's particularly important to realize that we have to look at the entire policy and the entire intent and the core purpose of those property damage policies to reach the proper conclusion. And in this case, I think what is easily the conclusion is that based on this state's previous interpretation of direct physical loss and damage, as well as treatment of general property policies throughout their existence, that they are directed at physical losses to physical things. In fact, Mastalone, which has been cited not only in Ohio but across numerous jurisdictions at this point in time, defines it as a distinct, demonstrable structural alteration to tangible property. That's not what occurs in
Council, let me ask a couple of questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
To understand your position a little better. If the place had flooded and the computer was messed up, it was in the basement, there'd be coverage.
Yes, there would.
Assume instead of paying the ransomers, the extortionists, they didn't pay, and instead of leaving the data on the system, the bad guys took the information to Russia, China, wherever, and kept it, and you could never find it again. Is that a physical loss?
I don't know that it's a physical loss, but it's a different loss that might have been covered under a different portion of the policy.
I agree. What
I would say is that this situation, quite honestly, is no different from those situations where you...
Well, I got another one.
Yes,
but if
sir.
They hadn't paid the ransom?
If they hadn't paid the ransom, that's what I was leading up to.
Okay.
It's no different than losing your password and getting locked out of your accounts. How many people have forgotten what that last password was, tried it three times, and then you can't get in? You got to reset the password. That's what happened here. And to put it in a tangible, physical form, it's like losing the keys to your safe deposit box or your safe. In this situation, all the stuff that's in that box is still there. And that's important in this case. It wasn't a case where there was corruption, deletion, anything else. That information was just temporarily inaccessible because you didn't have the key.
And then they'd have to hire somebody that has that capability to find the key, create the key, get into the lockbox, is that possible? Does that happen?
It can happen, sure. Digitally creating a key, like you would get a locksmith to open that up. But the focus is not on whether you can get that key. The focus is whether there is physical loss or damage.
Okay, if they never paid the ransom, and they hired two different companies, they came in, they tried to unlock the computer, the lock that the ransom, you know, the hijackers had put on there, and they couldn't do it. They didn't have the whatever it took to do it. Then what?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I do believe you still have to look at physical damage. Otherwise, you're dealing with economic loss only.
Okay, so the information that is contained in that lockbox is not physical, a physical entity, and that's what your basis is here.
Largely, yes, Your Honor. It does not have physical existence in and of itself. And in fact, there's courts across the country, not here in Ohio, that have addressed that specifically and said, you know, the ones and zeros that make up the information itself are intangible, incorporeal. They don't have physical existence and consequently cannot be physically damaged. What can be and what is defined in the policy is whether the medium on which they are recorded is physically damaged. Again, looking at physical materials and tangible damage to an item, not information. And that is really the key when you look at the general property coverage form or the electronic equipment coverage form that was in play in this case. And I think it is particularly clear if you contrast those forms with another endorsement that exists in this policy, which is the data compromise form. The data compromise form is the only form in this policy that does not require physical loss and damage because it is directed to a specific type of information breach. It's our position that that type of information breach did not occur here. However, it does reflect the fact that is a different type of coverage that was contemplated at the time this policy was issued.
And why does the data form coverage not, why is that not triggered?
I would say because the insuring agreement, it's in the data compromise endorsement, is directed to a situation where personal information of what is defined as an affected individual is leaked, released, stolen. The definitions that are in that policy define affected individual as an individual person, for one thing, and specifically excludes businesses and corporations as being an affected individual. EMOI dealt with businesses and corporations, for one thing.
Well, I thought the data compromise endorsement wasn't really at issue here. I thought it was the electronic equipment endorsement.
That is the claim that EMOI is pursuing. What I was bringing it up for, number one, was to contrast it with what is reflected in the electronics endorsement. And secondly, to point out the fact that the insuring agreement language is very different. It doesn't speak in terms of physical loss and damage. It talks about security risks, security breaches, information breaches, but it does contain exclusions in that particular form that address the very types of claims that EMOI is pursuing here, expressly including payment of ransom, payment of restoration of information, payment for securing your system against further incursions. Those are all excluded under there. And in fact, if you look at all the endorsements, they all say that all the rest of the terms of the policy apply in addition to what was in there. So arguably, all those exclusions also apply to any other claim that could be made under that policy.
So we're not really deciding the ultimate legal issue. We're just deciding whether there's a genuine issue of material fact, correct?
Well, I think that turns on the ultimate legal issue, and the ultimate legal issue is the proper interpretation of that key threshold, number one, whether there are other exclusions that are applicable. And then there is a third issue that's before the court, which has to do with the determination of whether an expert is necessary in this situation.
Can I just ask you one more question before you get to that issue?
Yes, ma'am.
The fact that the software was damaged even after it was unlocked and even affected the use of the telephones, we still want to call that not tangible?
Your Honor, anything, yes, to answer the question, yes. The alleged damage to the software was Number one, they had to rerun the decryption code, but it worked again. Number two, the difficulties with the phones were not determined until after they had obtained other security measures and updated other software, and that was part of that protection against future incursions as opposed to this particular thing. Third, it's still not physical. It's still the ones and zeros of the information. It was not the server that was damaged. It was not the computer that was damaged. It was not the equipment that interfaced with it. It was not anything defined as media, which is materials on which information is stored. Whether that information needed to be cleaned up or got affected by future acts is not a physical damage. According to the terms of this policy and the core intent, which you can perceive from the entirety of the policy, its history, and its form.
So if software is ones and zeros, as you say, how can software be transmitted? I mean, you know, in the old days, you had floppy disks, and then you had DVDs, and now it can be downloaded from the internet. But without those internet wires, how do we separate those out? Software can't exist without something to exist on.
And I think you struck on the very core of the difference between the two, because what is defined as media in this particular policy, and I think has been defined in other cases across the country, is that mechanism, is that physical, tangible form, your flash drive, your floppy disk, your hard drive, your server, where that information resides. In this case, the policy says that media includes the software and data that's on it, because if that media is damaged physically, say there's a fire or flood, lightning strike, whatever, that damages that physical media, they will replace what's on there. But if it's just the information that is at issue, there's nothing happened to any of the media on which it is stored or accessed, then that alone, esoterically, is not included in physical form.
Could you buy insurance for what we're talking about here?
Yes, you can. In fact, there is a whole separate market in the insurance industry that has developed because of the increasing tide of cyber information breaches that has created specialty insurance that contains entirely different insuring agreements. They speak in terms of information breaches, security risks, data compromise. They do not talk about physical loss or damage because it's recognized that doesn't occur.
They talk about restoration costs and that sort of thing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, you also in one of the briefs talked about theft. And that's
yes,
why I was getting to if the information had been transferred back to Russia or China or whatever.
Yes, and I did.
Would theft then apply?
I think I also said that we didn't think theft had occurred in this instance.
We don't know.
But if it had, it would be excluded because that was listed in one of the exclusions to either the business form or the electronics endorsement. In any event, I would like to touch briefly on the last point that was raised in our brief, which was the expert requirement. What this does is effectively reverse the burden that has been established in Ohio for a number of years and reiterated amongst a number of courts, that it is the insured's burden to establish that a loss has occurred and that loss is within the scope of the policy. This state has concluded in a variety of cases that until that happens, there's no duty to investigate, so that requiring, in this instance, as the Court of Appeals would have required, an expert to have been retained to determine whether coverage existed as an initial matter would essentially require an expert, a subject matter expert, in any case, particularly specialty cases. This adjuster was relying on information provided by its insured and the plain language of its policy and came to a conclusion, and that's what they do every day in a matter of course. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. You've saved a minute.
Thank you.
Is it Ignazi?
Yes. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Kenneth J. Agnozzi on behalf of the EMOI Services LLC. I heard a few things repeatedly. One was physical loss and damage. There's no physical loss and damage throughout the entire policy, and it's physical loss or damage, which is a big thing. It's a big difference. This case involves a simple construction of a contract.
And physical modifies both words? That would be the ordinary construction of that phrase?
Damage to physical. I mean, they're both adjectives, I think.
Right. Usually when you have a leading adjective, it modifies both.
And then we get to the question, is software physical or is it not? And, I mean, we know from...
So we know software's not physical, is it?
Well, physical in the sense of we know that it's... We all have it. We know that it's there. It does things for us every day in many ways. We know that there are zeros and ones. We know that there are electrons. And the most important thing is we know that this all-risk policy covers it.
So if you jumble the ones and the zeros, is that physical damage?
If it makes it inoperable, yes.
So why have the word physical at all? Seems to me that all you would need was damage.
Basically we have to understand this policy, I think, to begin with. This policy and the base policy, the business special services form, was promulgated in the mid-1980s. I think it was 1986. In 1986, I didn't have a cell phone of any sort or kind. I think I might have had the big giant floppy disk back then. So when you look at the language in the policy, it's archaic. And we have a business policy form that was written in the mid-1980s when we didn't have all this stuff. Times have changed. I mean, we can't hardly do anything at all without software. Businesses can't, people can't. In terms of filing things with this court.
That recognition of the exclusions, or excuse me, the presence of the exclusions in the policy, recognize that, what you're saying?
And I think it does. And in this case, when we look at the electronic coverage and the four corners, it's an adhesion contract, obviously. We have businesses that buy these policies to protect their business in case of peril. Admittedly, the policy, base policy, was in the mid-1980s, and then there's a whole bunch of, a couple hundred pages of endorsements that have changed things over the next, 35 years. A lot of the words in here you can see are not words that we use today, and that's because we had a floppy disk, then we had the small disk. Now you go to the store and you buy a computer, it doesn't even have a disk slot in it anymore. The times have changed. But what hasn't changed is the software, whether it's on a floppy disk, a little disk, whether it's on a computer, whether it's on the server, however it's accessed,
okay,
that hasn't changed.
So you have your data in the cloud. That's where your data is, right?
That's what everything has been leading to.
Okay.
Yes.
So you've got it in the cloud. Where's the cloud located?
I think there's two big farms, one out west.
Okay, but they're not affected by this. In fact, the data is probably sitting out there in the cloud. It's just can't be unlocked, right?
So if somebody, a business in Ohio, you're saying, has whatever they have and their data is in the cloud and it's somewhere else, the data is still there, yes?
Yes, the data is still there. So the data wasn't destroyed. What was destroyed was your capacity to get into that data, to access it. It's not a physical thing. And had it stored on floppy disks and in the cloud, you wouldn't have the problem because you'd be able to recreate based on your floppy disks, right? But what you're recreating is intangible.
Well, and that's what's covered in this policy, even with the endorsement.
Except your case, you had a server with drives and a backup server.
Correct.
So I'm not sure your information was in the cloud.
It was not.
Right. And so, you know, the very nature of the business is basically providing billing support services to medical providers. So it's data business. And if you could, since 1986, I mean, you know, there were still, you know, typewriters that sort of acted semi like computers with a little bit of memory in 1986, and maybe 1988, you were getting into the PCs. But here, by the time we get to 2019, there is cyber insurance. So if this is something that's 1986 language, I mean, compare the technology at the time and compare what's available by 2019, and it's just that EMOI didn't have it, right?
Well, as indicated in the record below in the testimony, the owner, the manager of the business testified he read this policy, and to him, it says exactly that he has coverage. He did have it.
Because he considered software to be physical.
Well, he considered software because software is covered. I mean, under the electronic equipment endorsement, it clearly says that we will pay for your costs to research, replace, or restore information on media which incurred direct physical loss or damage. And then the media, and this is the most important thing on the last page of the endorsement, the media is defined as materials which on which information is recorded, such as film, magnetic tape, paper, discs, drums, and cards. Okay, that's the physical thing. And then it says, media includes computer software and reproduction of data contained on the floppy disk or the drum or whatever. I mean, here, that's why we need clarity. In this policy, specifically software, not just the floppy disk, the physical part of it, but what is on it is covered. And they've agreed to, and it says in black and white, to pay for the cost to research it, replace it, restore it. And that's why when you look at proposition of law number one and this whole idea of ransomware, who knows if we'd ever had that. Why do I say that? Well, because the insurance company for the small business owner abandoned them right out the outset, immediately, same day. And what happened was they went and they researched it. So would ransom have been paid? Maybe, maybe not. We don't know, because the insurance company refused to provide coverage to pay to restore the information on the media. Not just media itself, but on the media. They refused to pay for it. And according to the record below, you can see that they got an estimate of, it was like going about $55,000 from an Australian company. And basically, the paying the ransom was about $35,000, which they didn't have. They borrowed it from family to get the $35,000 to buy the Bitcoin to pay the ransom, hoping that that would work, because it was a lot cheaper than the $55,000 estimate that they got. They didn't have the $35,000 to begin with. All of this happened because the insurance company denied their claim. So we don't know whether the ransom would have been paid or not because the owner's insurance company did not provide coverage as indicated on the electronic endorsement.
Counsel, in that electronic endorsement, the very last part that you read about the software, would you read that again?
Well, there's two sentences, and it's under definitions D. It says, media means materials on which information is recorded, such as film, magnetic tape, paper tape, discs, drums, and cards. Media includes computer software and reproduction of data contained on covered media.
Okay, and then there's language about a physical loss?
Well, in the very beginning of the electronic equipment endorsement on page one, I mean, it says for direct physical loss of or damage to.
Okay, so physical loss or physical damage.
And there was damage to the software on the disk, which is specifically covered.
Well, there wasn't any damage to the software. The software and its contents were still there.
Well, but the damage was, in the testimony, in the record below, the, well, quote-unquote, weird extensions on the files. the files, the data on the media was damaged. It was damaged in the part where nothing could be used. And so when you look at the four corners of the policy, and this is obviously what our position is, the reasonable interpretation, which is what we're asking the court to do, and that is provide clarity that this is an insurance policy for a business owner. It specifically covered the software on the media, not just the media itself, but on the media, the software, and it was damaged and it wouldn't work. And as far as the idea of being it ransomware or not, they may never have happened had they provided coverage to this business, who scrambled, and you can see the record below, the owner, the manager, where they were terrified because they were out of business and their insurance company abandoned them. They did everything they could, had to borrow money from family members to try and do something to get back into business so that people in Ohio can call the doctor and make an appointment, which obviously wasn't happening at the time.
So the hacking was, how was the hacking damage?
What the hacking did was it created file extensions on all the software, which is on the media. As I just keep saying media, but that's because they use this term here. But these file extensions, that's what damaged it. And in the record below, they contacted, after their insurance company abandoned them, they went themselves to contact estimates to see if the damage to the software on the media in their office, on their server, if that could be repaired or not and how much it cost, and that's all in the facts.
So ultimately what happened is that your client had to basically reinstall all the software anew and add the data back in. How did that come out?
Well, according to the testimony below, ultimately what happened is they paid the ransomware.
Right.
And that helped quite a bit, but not completely.
Well, it was like after somebody picked a lock, the key didn't work quite right.
Well, because there was damage to it and it needed to be repaired. And the repair was a link with some other software program by the ransomware. Bad person, and that worked to some extent, but didn't correct all the problems. There were still damage to the system, which is why they went and they moved servers, and they according to the record below, the IT guy testified all the details as far as what they did, and they moved things around. But it wasn't as simple as a key.
But I think I recall not all the data was recovered?
Correct.
So somehow in the process of the storage in the software, some data was never able to be retrieved.
As far as the actual data or the software, I think we need to look at the record below, but I mean, because there's the difference between the data itself
right.
and then the software.
Software is the framework and the data is the substantive stuff that you want to get to.
Well, that's in it. I think ultimately it took time, but they could get to all the data.
Okay.
Through all the workings that they did, that's described by the IT guy below.
Thanks.
But when you look at this and you look at the four corners of the policy, and admittedly the policy and all the endorsements are not great. This is the 21st century. We got iPhones in 2007, not in the mid-1980s when this policy was there. But it's the heart and soul, whether we like it or not, for literally all of us, to have software. A business owner, a small businessman in this case, bought an all-risk policy. Is he going to buy a policy that doesn't cover damage to his computer system that's going to shut him down? I mean, like it or not, literally everything that we do, and I know the Supreme Court's promulgation just, I think, roughly 30 days ago that all 88 counties in Ohio have to have not only an electronic filing system, but also the ability to retrieve documents and all that. I think the time period was 18 months, and we know now it's different all over the state. It varies greatly from county to county. I long for the days where I can go to the courthouse and file a paper or a brief or a lawsuit.
You long for those days?
I miss those days. Maybe reflecting my age, but I miss those days.
That's definitely physical property then.
Yes. Finally, I see I'm almost out of time.
Actually, you are out of time.
Apologize.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've saved about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I will try to use it effectively. Number one, what we've heard from counsel is the continued disassociation of the requirement that this damage be physical and the disassociation between the insuring agreement and what they would like it to be. The insuring agreement, especially in this electronics equipment endorsement, which was issued in 2013, not in 1986, is that it will pay for cost for damaged media that has incurred a direct physical loss or damage. The definition of media clearly includes software contained on materials because that's the way to record it. Those things did not happen here. The other thing that should be noted is that once the decryption key was obtained, access was restored. The testimony below was that the system could do the things that it did before the encryption. Anything else was caused or incurred because of attempts to improve the system to prevent this from happening again, which is different than the locking and unlocking of the system. And third, this small business owner could have purchased certain insurance covering cyber risk because they did. That cyber or that data compromise endorsement that's in this policy covers certain cyber risks. It was clearly available. That endorsement was issued in 2009, originally. It was included in this policy. There's clear distinction between what it covers as a cyber breach and what the balance of the policy, including the electronics endorsement, covers, which is direct physical loss or damage. If I misspoke and said and, it does say or. Physical modifies both of them, and the courts in Ohio have held that as well. And there simply was none here. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you're going to be notified of our decision. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the last case I will hear from this bench as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The live stream on Ohio Channel has been available to those of you watching remotely since 2002, making Ohio one of the first states to open the courtroom to the public in this way. It's easier to see the court in action. This kind of openness is important. I've had tremendous admiration and confidence in our American justice system all my life. It works because the people have confidence in it. Ohioans know that even if they don't prevail, justice in Ohio is conducted in the open. It is reliable, professional, respectful of all parties. Nearly 7 million people have watched streamed oral arguments since we first began. Originally, we had one camera wheeled around the courtroom to capture justices and then swung around to get the attorneys when they spoke. But from dial-up modem to streaming in high definition today, viewership keeps growing. Together, we have seen how the litigants give the pros and cons to their argument. We have heard interesting, challenging, heartbreaking, and yes, disturbing cases. But what you don't see is the hours upon hours of preparation by the justices and our staff, reading case briefs, drafting memoranda, researching case law, deliberating, debating, voting, and sometimes voting again on decisions, opinions, and orders to resolve disputes. While today is my last oral argument, this court session is not over. This court will issue opinions for all cases that have been considered on the merits by the end of this year when the makeup of this court changes. I believe that we have close to 100 opinions to dispose of. The wheels of justice continue to turn thanks to some very dedicated and professional Ohioans. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve the people of Ohio alongside my judicial colleagues. Since 2003, I have served with 20 justices on this bench. I was privileged to serve on the Moyer Court for 8 years before I became Chief Justice in 2011. I've heard over 2,500 oral arguments, written 421 majority opinions, and 140 separate opinions, 49 concurrences, 14 concur dissents, and then 77 dissents. I've also called upon many appellate judges to serve in the place of a recused justice over the years, as we saw in the first case today. My gratitude to those men and women who were willing to take on an extra duty and sit on the Supreme Court for the case. While justices have not always agreed, that is part of the process as well. With an open mind and an open heart, we have decided important issues, navigated a global pandemic, and returned to do more. In these oral arguments, you see seven justices and a few attorney advocates. What you don't see, as I said, is the hardworking people behind the scenes who support justice in Ohio. Thank you to the many lawyers, both in an appellate practice here and in the lower courts who represent the parties. The thousands of attorneys I have met over the years exemplify professionalism and a passion for justice, which makes the system work. Speaking of making the system work, we'd be nowhere without our IT department and Ohio Government TV, or OGT. You wouldn't even be seeing this, or any session for that matter. IT is the backbone of the court. From communication capabilities to broadcast to making sure oral arguments were conducted on Zoom throughout the pandemic, we relied on Robert Stewart and the IT team and the broadcast talents of OGT. Our attorney services division staff serve thousands of attorneys as well as thousands of people preparing to be attorneys, and they provide guidance and direction and monitor compliance with registration for those wishing to practice law in Ohio. Overseeing two bar exams a year takes place without a hitch, thanks to Gina Palmer and her staff. And one can't talk about attorney services without thinking of the work of the disciplinary counsel. Joe Caligiuri runs a tight ship, and Rick Dove's leadership of the Board of Professional Conduct gives us all confidence. I have to say, John Van Norman and the lawyers in the Chief Legal Counsel's office have also excelled in their duties. And Janet Green Marbley has managed the Lawyers Fund for client protection with her usual grace and dignity. When it comes to research for myriad things, Aaron Waltz and the library staff have come to the rescue by providing information in a swift and accurate way. Fiscal has done a marvelous job of seeing to it that the bills are paid, the lights stay on, and we don't exceed our budget, which they also create. I've never had a concern with Rhonda Carver crunching the numbers and bringing me back to reality at times. Speaking of crunching numbers, where would the court be without Brian Farrington supplying us with data and graphs that answer tough questions in an understandable format? I have attorneys in my chambers who research and draft and help us prepare, not just for oral arguments, but in every stage of filing, from intake to a decision. This is often long hours of dedicated work. It's where they excel in their attention to detail. I have been blessed to have employed intelligent, thoughtful attorneys to work in my chambers. Thank you to my current staff attorneys, Amy Irvin, Sarah Stafford, John Shelb, and Tori Gooder, as well as those who work for each associate justice. And thank you to Beth Long and our master commissioners, as well as Doug Nelson and the assistant reporters for your expertise, the long hours, and the commitment to the rule of law. My executive assistant, Myla Dennison, stepped into her position seamlessly earlier this year. She soon found out that I need an organized person to keep me on track for meetings, appointments, and deadlines. She does it all. The Supreme Court Court Services Division, led by Stephanie Nelson, provides information and assistance to courts throughout Ohio. Municipal, county, and common pleas courts and appellate courts are stronger for the tireless commitment of the Court Services Division. The people of Ohio, particularly those served by specialty courts, are on a better path as a result of the passion of these people. I applaud and recognize the Supreme Court Judicial College and the tireless efforts of Milt Newsom and Christy Tull and their teams. Well done always. Without them, the judges of Ohio would not be as well prepared to do their jobs. A special thank you to Diane Hayes, who not only shepherds visiting appellate judges when they sit on the Supreme Court, but manages the visiting judges' assignments for the Ohio courts on a daily basis. Together, we've solved a lot of problems, and I shall miss Diane. The civic education efforts of our court are second to none, and we have Sandra Day O'Connor Award for Civic Education to prove it. Thank you to Sarah Stifler and Mason Farr. One of the most difficult jobs is done by the small but mighty courts clerk staff led by Sandra Grosco. The clerk's office are the traffic cops for all matters that are filed in the Supreme Court. Accuracy and attention to detail are essential to the role of a clerk. I have to think that since we've gone to e-filing, not only have thousands of trees been saved, but the public has access to those filings 24/7. Some of our staff focus their efforts on work that is essential for any business, public or private. I'm speaking of our very important tasks, such as the Office of Human Resources and the work led by Christine Kidd, and the Office of Public Information led by Lynn Tolan. I also am looking forward to the work of our newly created Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, led by Adrienne Fletcher, and she's off to a great start. Each one of our divisions and departments are staffed by professional, competent, and caring people. The beauty and majesty of the Thomas J. Moyer Ohio Judicial Center is maintained due to Director Tony Joyce and our facilities, housekeeping, and grounds staff. I have to thank Chris Lozen and the staff of meetings and events for their excellent service when the building is a site for meetings, both large and small. And also the mailroom. We can't forget that we receive a ton of mail and send out a ton of mail too. And sometimes it has to be overnighted. We are safe because of Jim Capelli and court security. Each division and department are led by men and women who are highly regarded because of their professionalism, concern for the institution that is the court, and the genuine concern for each other, our staff. At the top of that food chain is our interim administrative director, Stephanie Hess. To say that she is competent is an understatement. There is no one who cares more about our court and the court system in Ohio than Stephanie Hess. On a personal note, I have always been able to trust the advice given to me by Stephanie. When making decisions, I invariably say to Stephanie, "Tell me where I'm wrong on this." And then she does. I will miss that. And thank you to the voice who opens the court and calls this court to order, Marshal Bill Crawford. Beyond what you see, there's a tireless dedication to the court, to the cause of justice in Ohio, and to me personally. He has been a friend and a steady presence in every circumstance, even before I became chief. He protects the dignity of the institution, and for that, thank you seems inadequate. The Ohio Constitution is telling me it's time to do something new. So at the end of the year, after 12 years of Chief Justice and 20 years on this court, I'll be Maureen O'Connor, private citizen. People have already started to ask me what I'm most proud of in my tenure. How do I choose? We've expanded treatment for people suffering from substance abuse disorder in the courts, which can involve veterans with PTSD and others with mental health issues. We've convened a collaborative effort in 2016 called Our Joy that brought together 8 states to collaborate, to share information, and to break down silos when dealing with the opioid epidemic. Increasing transparency, cameras in the courts, which actually brings the public into the courts. I've been a vocal advocate for cameras in the courts, including the United States Supreme Court. What a teaching opportunity that would be. And here is the most important and crucial current initiative, creating a uniform criminal sentencing database so that we can have transparency in the aggregate sentencing practices for felonies. Sarah Andrews is indispensable in this effort. Advocating for constitutional bail practices and the ability to pay hearings before determining court fines and fees and more has also been a passion of mine. The bottom line is that I did not do any of this alone. You have heard me say often, I do say it a lot, I hire people smarter than me and let them work. Let them innovate and create, and I support them in their efforts. In addition to our roles in the courtroom, judges have the power to address social problems and participate in efforts to develop policies and practices. Whether it be substance abuse treatment, eviction help, data collection, or any other project or problem that improves the justice system. Is that judicial activism? No. That's using the privilege of your office to better the system that is incumbent upon every judge and justice. My feeling has always been a good judge is one who can bring people together to find solutions. We all need to recognize that true justice is not a world of winners and losers. It's not a game of fight to the death. True justice considers the needs of the participants and finds common ground. When possible, everyone walks away with something. For that spirit of finding solutions, I thank all the judges, the attorneys, the court staff, citizens, everyone who joined a task force, an advisory committee, or a commission and made a better system of justice during my tenure. Your input has modernized the justice system. Please make a commitment to continue improving the justice system in Ohio. Let that be the history of the last 20 years in the Ohio judiciary and also its path forward. God bless you, and God bless the best system of justice in Ohio. Marshall, will you adjourn court?
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.